Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain, and this is Radio Times in Review, our weekly show when we go back into our archives and highlight some of the best conversations from Radio Times past. Coming up on today's show, we'll listen to Marty's 1995 interview with writer, activist, and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel. Wiesel died last weekend. He authored 57 books, including Night, which described his experiences at the infamous Auschwitz concentration camp. We'll also hear from Anna Bodkin. She joined Marty last year to discuss her time traveling with the nomadic cowherders of Mali, known as the Fulani. But first, we'll hear from Ai Jen Poo, director of the Domestic Workers Alliance. She joined Marty last year to talk about the upcoming challenges of what she calls the elder boom. That's all coming up when Radio Times in Review continues after the news from NPR. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscawain. Thanks for joining us today. By the year 2030, 20% of Americans will be aged 65 or older. This will present a number of policy and social challenges, as well as an increased need for elder care in this country. Activist and director of the Domestic Workers Alliance, Ai Jen Poo, outlines the upcoming elder boom and how we can better equip ourselves to provide for the baby boomers as they enter old age. She talked with Marty about all of this after her book, The Age of Dignity, was published. Let's take a listen.
Are we prepared as a country, as families, as individuals for the elder boom that's already taking place?
We are not prepared. The elder boom is a demographic shift and phenomenon that's going to change the way we live and work and play in this country, and we have not adequately prepared. I know in my family, we didn't have a plan, and that had a disastrous impact in terms of my grandfather, who was forced to live in a nursing home for the last 3 months of his life against his wishes. And so I think that it's time. It's time. We can't afford not to have a plan at this point.
Do you think the way baby boomers, and I have to admit, I am a baby boomer, so in certain ways I am talking about myself here, but the baby boomers, because of just the sheer number of them, I mean, they changed adolescence in many ways, parenthood, middle age. Do you think they are also changing what it means to be an older person?
Absolutely. I think that is one of the main reasons why I'm as optimistic as I am and why my book is so hopeful. If ever there was going to be a generation to change the way we think and feel about aging in this country, it is going to be the generation who brought us rock and roll.
So I'm glad you
feel
that way.
I have a lot of faith, absolutely.
But we also hear that people saving for their retirement, whether Social Security or putting money aside, and I guess ready to retire, people do not have the money largely that they're going to need as they live into older age.
That's right. The economic pressure on working families today is such that there's very little room. And it is an all hands on deck situation where individuals are going to have to plan and save. Families are going to have to plan and save. And frankly, this country is going to have to prioritize the family caregiving needs of working families in particular in a way that it hasn't in the past. And so we actually need a whole new approach to caregiving. And I think that that's where the opportunity lies. We have a patchwork system at best, really no system at all at worst. A lot of people say we have nothing in place to really support the vast majority of Americans in terms of the care that they need. And so here's the opportunity to take a long-standing challenge in terms of families being able to afford the care that they need, the workforce that we count on to care for us, actually being able to turn these jobs into good jobs for the future that you can really support your family on. This is the win-win opportunity as we think about the future and preparing for the elder boom.
You write in your book about a woman named Mrs. Sun who took care of your grandfather, and the kind of dedication that she had for his care, pretty extraordinary. But I know from others who have had care workers working with their families, many of them are pretty extraordinary as well in terms of their dedication for this really difficult kind of work.
Yes, if you, many of us probably know somebody who does caregiving as a profession, and you know that it's you're a nutritionist, you're a nurse, you're a cook, you're so many things at once, and it takes enormous amount of skill, dedication, hard work, focus. I mean, these jobs are really skilled and difficult jobs that this professional workforce does with a tremendous amount of care and commitment. And for this hard work and dedication to our families, the average median income for a home care worker in this country is $13,000 per year.
Wow.
And I don't know a single city or town in this country in which you could survive and support your family on that income. And so we've got a really dangerous contradiction here where the people that we count on to care for our families cannot care for their own.
You know, it reminds me of the problem with good quality child care, which is that it costs a lot of money. And if you're a working person and you're not making a lot of money, a lot of your income is going in to pay for child care. Is it similar when we're talking about older folks?
It is similar. And it goes to a root issue here, which is that our economy in this country, and it's different in other countries. Many countries in Europe have subsidies and other supports when it comes to family care. We here in the United States have never fully acknowledged the work and time it takes to raise families, children, or supporting our elders as they age. And families are really left on their own to struggle and to support their aging loved ones or their children in the care that they need. And it's kind of an impossible situation, especially for the 40 million plus who are struggling with both child care and elder care. And so I think what we need is a rethinking, because at the end of the day, we are already paying a tremendous amount for this care. We're just doing it in incredibly inefficient ways that are a real struggle and a bit of a free-for-all, where some people are, you know, getting insurance, some people are hiring under the table, and there's no systems or real protections for anyone involved or support, really.
Are we also talking in many ways about an invisible workforce, and that makes it, if it's invisible, then you can ignore it?
That's right. I think that the workforce that works in our homes is in many ways, by definition, somewhat invisible. You could go into any neighborhood or any apartment building and not know which apartments or which homes are actually somebody's workplace. And that is part of the challenge of ensuring that these jobs are good jobs, which is why it's so important that we go the extra mile to really be intentional about how we do that.
But let's say we want to pay home care workers $15 an hour, something like that. I'm not sure exactly what that is. It's probably, you know, $40,000 a year. But if a family has to pay for this, you know, where do they get the money in order to provide a professional salary for someone who's working to take care of a family member?
Right. Well, here's the thing, is that families are already paying for this care. So the average nursing home stay, private room in a nursing home, costs over $87,000 per year. Now, that's unimaginable for the 27 million of us who will be needing some form of care or assistance by the year 2050. On top of that, our Medicaid programs reimburse agencies at rates of over $20 per hour for home care. And on top of the low wages that workers are, so on the other end of the reimbursements, workers are earning very low wages, and the low wages are forcing many to rely on public assistance just to put food on the table. And so there are lots of ways that we're already paying for this care in inefficient and very, very costly ways both privately as individual households and through public funding mechanisms. And so I would say that we need to strengthen how we think about our public funding and update it for the 21st century, as well as think about how we are both saving and reorganizing our services and our care to better support home and community-based care, because the institutional model is very expensive.
And I know, Ai-Jen, you are very positive about what we can do about addressing some of these problems, but I just want to ask whether you think part of the problem is that we're talking about workers who are probably largely female and older Americans who are probably largely female as well. Is this a female issue that we're talking about?
You know, women really are on the front lines of this age wave in every dimension. When we think about our life expectancy, women actually live longer on average than men. And then in terms of family caregivers, about 73% of all family caregiving work is done by women in families. And in terms of the professional caregiving workforce, over 90% of the professional caregiving workforce is women. And so absolutely, this is an issue that disproportionately impacts women, which is why it's so important that women are a large part of shaping the solutions, and why we have a holistic approach that is inclusive of the perspectives and experiences of women on every side of this equation.
Well, and I know, having gone through this and having had friends who have gone through this as well, on the one hand, wanting to keep one's parents at home, but also worried that they're not going to be safe, or that they're going to do something that's going to hurt themselves, or knowing if there's a snowstorm, perhaps that care worker is going to be able to get there. There are a lot of logistics that they go into ensuring that someone is going to, you know, age in place and be safe in place.
There's so many logistics, and it's really challenging for families that are living far apart. A significant number of family caregivers are managing the care of their parents and other relatives from long distances. And that makes the role of the professional caregiver even more important. And potentially here, there's a role for technology as well in terms of facilitating good communication and coordination between families, seniors, the professional caregivers, and healthcare professionals. There's a lot that can be done to really upgrade how we think about care. And it's about really making this visible and our families proactively preparing for these changing needs in such a way that allows us to tap into some of these resources.
So how do you suggest we address these intersecting problems then?
Well, I think we need public policy solutions as well as nonprofit, and every family actually has to participate in this as well. On the public policy front, there are sort of three core principles that we believe need to be at the heart of any viable solution. One is affordability and accessibility of quality care for families. The second is maximum choice, the choice to age at home, in the community, or in a nursing home receiving quality care. There's such a range of needs and situations that families are experiencing around this country, and choice is very key. And the third is quality jobs for the workforce. We are going to need a stable, strong professional workforce to support the millions of family caregivers out there. We are going to need a national care force that is not only strong, but continues to grow into the future, millions more in this workforce. And in fact, home care is the fastest growing occupation in the nation already because of the rising demand for this work. So those three elements have to be at the center of any public policy solution. And there are ways of making incremental steps towards that vision that are possible today.
That was Marty's 2015 interview with the director of the Domestic Workers Alliance, Ai-Jen Poo, about her book, The Age of Dignity. When we get back from the break, we'll hear Marty's 1995 interview with Auschwitz survivor Elie Wiesel. Stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Elie Wiesel's 1955 book Night, which elegantly and vividly describes the horrors of his time at the Auschwitz and Buchenwald concentration camps, has become one of the most definitive accounts of the Jewish Holocaust. Through his writing and teaching, Wiesel emerged as a global voice for human rights and human decency. After 57 books, a Nobel Peace Prize, advocating for victims of oppression from all over the world, and aiding the establishment of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum, Wiesel's life ended last weekend at the age of 87. Marty had a chance to speak with Wiesel in 1995 when filling in for Terry Gross on her show Fresh Air. He joined Marty to discuss his memoirs, All Rivers Run to the Sea. Let's take a listen.
In your memoirs, you do detail some events in Jewish history when Jews turned on Jews, the Jewish capos beating other Jews in the concentration camps. Is that in any way comparable to what happened in Israel?
No. Well, murder is murder. But you cannot compare. The capos were victims too, after all. They were Jews, and as Jews, they were sentenced to death by Hitler and his acolytes. Therefore, I am not so harsh on the Judenelsters, the Judenrat, what they call them, the Council of the Jews in the ghettos, or the capos. There were very few. Some were brutal, cruel, inhuman, but there were very, very few. And even they, in the end, they too were killed. In this case, you have a young man who lived in a free, independent, sovereign land. He should be grateful to what is happening in Israel, grateful that after 2,000 years of exile, Israel exists as a sovereign land. And for him, therefore, to abuse that sovereignty by killing the man who incarnated, the man who symbolized the sovereignty of Israel as prime minister, was wrong, was crazy, was criminally crazy.
In a democracy, what then can be done with extremist groups, those that speak out against the government and against the peace process?
Speak out as their liberty. I believe in democracy. There is no substitute to democracy. And it's good that people speak for and against. I am not saying that those who oppose the peace process are traitors. Never would I say that. I think they are patriots just like the others are. But no violence. Violence occurs only when language dies. If people can no longer talk to each other, or when they use a language which is an anti-language, then violence occurs. So we have, I think, to reestablish everywhere in America, in the American Jewish community, and in Israel. But who am I to give advice to Israelis? I wouldn't live there. But we should reestablish a kind of civility and humanity in our discourse and in our debates.
Well, I do want to talk about your life, and certainly you write about it in your memoirs. You grew up in a town in Hungary, a shtetl, as you say, a typical shtetl called Sziget.
It was a really typical Jewish town. At that time, I think there were some 25,000 inhabitants, some 15,000 Jews, between 12 and 15,000 Jews. It was a Jewish town, which means on Saturday most shops were closed. And the town became very quiet, very calm. And on most streets, you could go from house to house, let's say Friday evening, and hear the same songs. And if you went from one street to the other, you will follow the song, actually. The first song, which is to invite the angels of peace to enter with us into the room and greet the Sabbath, which is the day of peace, the night of peace, the time of peace. On high holidays, the same thing. Even the non-Jews knew Jewish laws. Even the non-Jews would, for instance, know never to offer a cake or bread or meat all year, but bread during Passover. And the Jews felt secure. Oh, from time to time there were anti-Semitic incidents. You know, why should be different from other Jews in other places in those lands? On Easter, for instance, there were anti-Semitic hooligans who attacked young people or old people. And on Christmas, so we stayed home.
Before the outbreak of World War II, as a little boy, what did you think your grown-up life was going to be?
My ideal, my dream, was to be a writer, strangely enough, and a teacher, which I am now. Except I wanted to teach only Talmud and commentaries. and become somewhere in a small place, in a small village, probably Rosh Yeshiva, meaning head of the Talmudic Academy. That was my dream. And write commentaries on important sacred books. Lo and behold, I'm a teacher and a writer. I do not write the same things.
Well, after the German occupation of Hungary, you write about the fact that wearing the yellow star scarcely bothered you. The creation of the ghetto was, quote, almost a relief. Was that you? Or was that the Jews of Sziget, that they saw this as just the next step or a very benign act?
It was surely I and my young friends. For the adults, I don't know. I feel they also felt the same way. Because why did we feel that way? Because we didn't know. Again and again I speak about that. The crime of indifference, the crime of silence with regard to Hungarian Jews was what? That we didn't know. The Hungarian Jewish community was the only one who could have been saved because the deportation came so late. The first deportation occurred mid-May, which means 3 weeks away from D-Day.
Okay, and then this was 1944?
44. This community could have been saved, but nobody cared.
In May of 1944, who knew about the Final Solution?
What do you mean? In Washington?
In
New York? In Stockholm? In the Vatican? In Switzerland? Check the New York Times. Check the Philadelphia Inquirer. You will see that already in 42, late 42, they spoke about the Final Solution. The names Auschwitz were known, except to us. When we, from Sziget, from Hungary, came to Auschwitz, we saw the name Auschwitz, we had no idea what it meant. And therefore the ghetto was a kind, offered us a secure shelter to be with Jews, not to have to see the German soldiers, the German SS, when they came, or to see the anti-Semites. We felt good in the ghetto, but the whole thing lasted a few weeks, that's all.
It's so hard to understand that, I guess, in 1995, how a story could be in newspapers in 1942 and not be known around the world.
Well, it was war, and papers didn't reach, New York Times didn't reach Sziget. Further, those who read didn't tell us. There were radios, but we had no access to radios. It was forbidden for a Jew to own a radio. And again, if, let's say, we could have remembered, let's say, Moshe, the Beadle, his warnings. But he was a Beadle, the lowest of his class. Why should we listen to a Beadle? We thought he was crazy because he lost his family somewhere. He was crazy. He lost his mind. And why believe him? Had, let's say, a Roosevelt broadcast an appeal to Hungarian Jewry, don't board the trains, you may be sure we would have taken his words seriously, or Churchill, or Ben-Gurion.
The convoys then began in May of 1944. When you and your family were boarded onto the cattle cars, where did you think you were going?
In the beginning, we thought we were going to a Hungarian labor camp in Hungary. That was the rumor, that we are not going to leave Hungary. That Hungary will protect us. After all, we were Hungarian citizens. Again, had we known even that we were being deported to Poland, many of us would have escaped to the mountains. The Russians were 20 miles away. And the ghetto it was easy to leave the ghetto, to sneak out of the ghetto, to quit and go into hiding. It was possible for many, many, many Jews in Sziget and elsewhere. But we didn't know. We thought we were going to Hungary, to a labor camp. And they even told us families will remain together. Again, the key word was together.
And yet you write, life in the cattle cars was the death of my adolescence, how quickly I aged. And I got the feeling that very soon after the cattle cars left, you realized that there was something much more horrifying waiting for you.
A premonition, especially when we left, when we left the border. And we entered Poland. A premonition was there. We didn't know its name nor its face, but it was there. The main fear was not to die or be killed, but to be separated.
Well, you arrived in Auschwitz. You were 15, and The men and women were separated from each other. You were separated from your mother and your sister and never saw them again.
I saw my older sisters, but not my little sister.
But
not
your little sister.
No. I see them in my dreams.
Well, I was wondering how much you think about them now.
Well, I think that most of us, or many of us at least, who went through this experience, now we dream more than before about that period. Maybe we try to retain certain events, certain words, certain smiles, certain tears. And since we cannot, we bring them back into our dreams.
I wonder, too, at the age of 15, and here you were in Auschwitz, what you thought then was the fate of your mother and your sisters. What did you think was going to happen to them when you looked around you?
It depends when. For the first few days, I was in a haze. But afterwards, we knew, we didn't talk about it, but we knew that they were no longer alive. We knew with certainty that the first night swallowed them in its flames.
I'm curious how you were able to start your life again after having lost most of your family, and at that point you thought you were an orphan, and certainly having been through the kind of experience that you've been through at both Buchenwald and Auschwitz. How does one start again?
First, one continues. One doesn't start again. As I told you, I became very religious. I opened the same tractate of a Talmud which I had interrupted in 1944. And I had friends. And we studied together. We prayed together. And life has a very strong appeal. The problem was not how to adjust to life. The problem was how to adjust to death. Because for us, before, that was nothing. That was the norm. Death. You slept with dead people. You didn't feel anything when you saw a dead corpse. And then you had to adjust to that. That is a scandal. That is always an outrage. An outrage to creation, an outrage to humanity. People shouldn't die. I would like to think of every human being that I meet as a candidate for immortality. And that was the difficulty. It took time. I didn't know a word of French then. I had to study French. Then went to the Sorbonne, studied there. Became a journalist, and all that, as I try to describe, it was funny. At one point, it became funny. I fell in love with every girl I met. I fell in love. Didn't last long, because it was never reciprocated. But I felt I needed not to love, not to be loved. I needed to love. I needed to know that I was capable of love. And therefore, I tell so many funny stories about me being in love. Then, as a journalist, but my experiences as a journalist, I had to readjust there to meet people more important than I. I remember an interview I had to conduct with a Miss Europe. I, who was so bashful that I blushed whenever I saw a girl, had to interview the most beautiful woman in Europe. And because I asked for interview and it was arranged for me, and she had already a press agent probably. And I came to see her in her apartment, and it was hilarious because she was waiting for my questions. I didn't know what to ask. So I said to her the truth. I said, "Lady, I have never done it. It's not my field. My field is to interview political personalities or writers, but not beauty queens. What should I ask you?" So she said, "First of all, ask me what I ate today." I asked what she ate and what kind of exercises and so forth. And then she gave me a few numbers. And I thought she gave me her telephone number. It was her measurements. Well, you can imagine what the success of such an interview. And so forth. Really, therefore, except for the first chapter about the war, I wanted to show here that life afterwards had not only humor but also joy. And that is the absurd discovery one makes, that afterwards one is capable of joy, because one must give joy, not only receive it. If I don't receive it, I don't give it. If I don't give it, that means I have not received it. We live with people, and I cannot burden those that I like or those that I know or don't know all the time with my sad memories. It's wrong. So, therefore, all the rivers run to the sea.
When did you feel it was safe enough to write about
what had happened in Buchenwald and Auschwitz.
I had made a vow in 1945 when I came to Paris. I began writing a diary, and these memoirs really are based on those diaries. I wrote every single day. But I decided also that I will not write about that period for 10 years. I took a vow of silence for 10 years. I wanted to be sure that the words that I use will be the proper words. I wanted to be sure that I will not cheat or lie or find some beautiful phrases simply because they are beautiful. And therefore it took me 10 years.
And have you ever found the right words?
I do not think so. Truly so. I, whenever I finish a book, I always know it's not what I wanted to say.
And that's because, what, there literally aren't words? Or...
Exactly. There are no words.
How much are you haunted today? Because certainly you lost your parents, you lost siblings as well from the death camps. How much are you haunted by the question of what we would have done if we had known about the Final Solution?
Oh, I lost my parents and my little sister, but I am haunted by it all the time. All the time. And if I feel anger at times, it's really, that is the anger. Why our friends, the allies, the liberals, the great humanists in America, England, so forth, why they abandoned us? Why we didn't exist for them? Why they simply accepted already that we were no longer alive, although we were still living. That is something which hurts and will continue to hurt. I rarely spoke about it. You know, I've written almost 40 books. And about the Holocaust, I've written maybe 4 or 5. The only memoir from before was Night, a short, very short narrative on what happened to me. But even there, I didn't speak about my father or my mother or my little sister because it was too close. And I was afraid if I spoke, I would cry. Here in this memoir, I do, because years and years and years go by, and I would like some words to remain.
That was Marty's 1995 interview with author and Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, who died last weekend. When we get back from the break, we'll hear about the nomadic Fulani people of Mali. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. We close out today's show by listening to Marty's interview with writer Anna Bodkin about her book, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. Bodkin, whose previous works chronicle her time in Afghanistan, spent a year traveling with the nomadic cowherding tribe of Mali called the Fulani. She spoke with Marty last year to talk about the history and changing culture of the tribe and West Africa as a whole. Let's take a listen.
You describe the Fulani as cowboys. Who are the Fulani?
The Fulani are, well, according to the Western point of view, the Fulani are a huge ethnic group comprising about 20 million people, maybe more, across the Sahel, which is the belt that separates the Sahara Desert and the African tropics. From the point of view of the Fulani are a people who comprise certain qualities, physical qualities such as tall, lean, not very dark-skinned, long-nosed, very skinny, and emotional qualities or characteristics such as stoic and not showing a lot of emotion. But so, you know, in the globalized world, a Fulani, I know a Fulani doctor in New York. I know a Fulani mechanic and a bunch of Fulani mechanics, actually, in Philadelphia. But the Fulani with whom I spent time are completely nomadic. So they don't have homes. They herd their cattle, their zebu cattle, very beautiful, short, stocky, lyre-horned cattle across the Sahel, and this is their livelihood.
And this is something they have been doing, the Fulani have been doing in this part of Africa for, what, thousands of years now? Several thousand years, certainly.
They are the direct descendants of the people who started the agricultural, the Neolithic Revolution, when people settled down about 12,000 years ago, and some started farming and some started herding animals, domesticated animals, and started herding them. So the Fulani came from that latter group that originated in eastern Africa in what today is Ethiopia and Kenya, and they moved northward through the Sahara Desert and then descended into West Africa.
You were able to connect with this Fulani family, and in many ways the book is about what their life is about. How were you able to do that, especially from Philadelphia?
I knew where I wanted to be. I wanted to be in this particular part of Mali in the crook of the Niger Delta, inner Niger Delta, because that used to be 200 years ago a very powerful Fulani empire called the Masina Empire. And so I knew that I wanted to be there. And I made contact with an interpreter who put me in touch with this Fulani sort of middleman. They're called Jawandos, and the Jawandos are sort of advisors. They coordinate veterinarian needs of Fulani nomads or legal needs of Fulani nomads. So I had to have this introduction. I walked up to this gentleman in very beautiful flowing robes in the middle of Djenne, the old medieval city in central Mali. He was watching the Africa Cup of Nations
as was
everybody else in that square.
Right.
And I explained to him what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to essentially be adopted by a family of nomads and to write about what it's like to see the world, to experience the world at the pace of 3 miles an hour. And he thought about it. And then he said, bon, your work is good. Then the next day, my Jawando advisor took me to the bush to introduce me to his client family and said, this is Anna Ba. She will be spending time with you. And my future hosts laughed, and I knew that we had it.
How would you describe them? And in many ways, they're fascinating, especially this husband and wife.
Umaru Infante, Umaru Jakaete is probably in his he's in his early 80s or very late 70s. And his wife, his second wife, Fanta Sankari, his first wife died during a famine in the 80s. I'm not sure whether she starved to death or died of illness, but he had two small children on his hands and he really needed desperately a woman to take care of them. Fanta Sankari had actually been divorced, which is not very common in a Muslim society. She was a divorced mother of one. He proposed. She agreed. She accepted. They're so in love, Marty.
Well, that's what really struck
me. They're so in love. It's amazing. Fanta travels a lot. Fulani women travel a lot on foot, very far away, to see relatives. And the way they do it is they say, I heard that such and such is sick, and it will take me 2 days to walk there. I leave in the morning. Goodbye.
And the husband doesn't object?
Well, he doesn't. He can't. Well, and if he does, then there will be a quarrel. So Umaru would definitely object. He would say, oh, you're not strong enough to walk that far. It's very far. And she would say, I know. And he would say, I don't think you're strong enough. And she would say, I must go. And then she would go. And he would miss her so much. You could tell she would be gone for a couple of weeks, and you could tell that he was sad and lonely mm-hmm. without her.
What was interesting is their life really revolves around cattle. And you write that the men own the cattle, the women own the milk, the manure belongs to no one. But it's interesting that sort of that is, I guess, their currency.
Yes, it's a pre-modern economy that is run by women because everything that you want for your household, you're going to get by bartering or selling milk or milk products. It's usually buttermilk and butter. Because women own the milk, so men will bring the cows back from pasturage and milk the cows and then hand over the milk to the women. And it's up to the woman to decide what she wants to do with the milk. She can, if she is a responsible woman in a family, she will probably see what the family needs and then go and barter that milk for millet or rice or some fish or maybe some oil or maybe some sugar and tea. If she's an irresponsible woman, she can go and sell the milk and buy herself jewelry. And nobody will have the right to object because that's hers. She can do whatever she likes with it. I've not actually seen women trade milk for jewelry and keep their
families
hungry.
They're more responsible than that.
Absolutely. Of course. Yeah.
But as you say, there's no, I guess, no actual currency as we think of it.
Right. So think of cows as sort of your retirement account and think of goats and sheep as your checking account. Fulani usually will keep some small animals. So in case somebody needs to go to the hospital or there's an urgent expense, let's say you have to vaccinate your herd and you have to pay for vaccination, the Fulani will say, sell a goat and use that money to finance their day-to-day life.
That's a checkbook.
That's the checkbook. Women often keep chicken and sometimes guinea hens. And again, they will either sell the eggs or sell the chicken if they need some extra cash. But cash really doesn't do you very much in the bush. You want food and you want water, and that's something that money can't really buy.
What is the path that they take? I mean, as they're migrating, as they're going with their cattle, looking, I guess, for food, looking for water, what's point A, what's point B?
It depends on the family. Each family has its own point A, B, and C. It's an annular migration, so it's almost like a circle. But basically, there is a place where you spend the rainy season, and then there is a place where you spend the dry season. And the place where you spend the dry season, which in Mali happens from around October, November till around May, is also the place that is best for farming. So when the rains begin, Fulani have to leave because the land where they would graze their cattle is also the land where farmers plant their millet and rice.
One of the things that they have observed and are frankly living through, and you got to see as well, is just how climate change is affecting where their herds can go, what they find when they get there, the fact that it's hotter, it's probably drier. And you even described the fact that it's affecting their diet. They have lived largely on milk and milk products. But I guess when cattle can't get enough to eat, they're not producing the milk, and there are consequences.
Droughts are cyclical in the Sahel, and they always had been cyclical, except the cycles are shrinking. So if you could expect a drought every 100 years until about 100 years ago, then you could expect a drought. Well, you never expect a drought, but there would be a drought every 20, 30 years. Now there are killer droughts almost every year or two. And experts who study these things, meteorologists, predict that in a couple of decades, it will be just one big drought. So the Fulani are observing this. They have never heard. My hosts, who were unlearned, they were illiterate, unschooled, they had never heard of climate change, but they could describe with absolute precision its symptoms. And they are extremely worried because, yes, their lifestyle is changing. Their livestock is dying. How far are they going to have to go next year for pasturage during the rainy season? And what about the year after that? And add to that the fact that there is a war just about 100 miles north of where their dry season camp is. Some Fulani families, not my host family, but some of their relatives who used to take their cattle up north no longer can because that's a war zone. So the jihad and climate change are recharting these 100-year-old, hundreds of years old routes of migration.
Where will they go? Or do they not know? And the father of this host family asks, how will we keep cows in the city?
Mm-hmm. Because there is a prediction among among demographic experts in the West that within 100 years, we all will be settled and living in city. Right now, there are between 30 and 40 million nomads in the world, and 20 of them are Fulani. But if in 100 years we all will be living in cities, then Umaru wonders,
yes,
what's he going to do with his cows?
But where can they go? I mean, do they even know yet? As you say, these are people who are extraordinarily adaptable. Survival is what they really know how to do best. Where
Absolutely.
Will they go?
That's a very good question. Well, of course, the more educated Fulani cattle owners, they figured out that instead of keeping a herd of, say, 200 head of cattle, they can interbreed their sturdy little zebu cows with Holsteins. And these interbreeds will be much larger, but they will give much more milk and they won't eat as much grass, because cows are also responsible
sure.
for desertification.
Sure.
You know, when you have huge herds that now don't die because they are vaccinated, they only die of starvation. They used to die, you know, of rinderpest periodically or some other plague. Right now, these cows are, you know, mostly healthy. So you have these massive herds, you have expanding farms, you have desertification because of man-made climate change to boot. So some of the wealthier Fulani people are figuring out, okay, well, I will actually move to the city and I will keep my cattle, but I will interbreed it and it will give me much more milk and I won't have to keep 100 head, I will keep 10. But to tell my host Umaru that he has to give up his cattle and swap it for 10, he would be shocked, because cattle in his tradition and his custom is everything. How can you willingly cut down the number of heads?
You mentioned the fact that they're rather close to a war zone, if we can put it that way. I mean, wars no more sort of follow borders or anything like that. And you also describe some of the Fulani taking up the fight. I mean, fighting with some of these terrorist organizations.
Yes, and actually that has intensified since I was in Mali the last few months. There is this new terrorist organization, the Liberation Front of Masina, that operates exactly where my hosts are herding their cattle. And that's a Fulani group.
And is it because of the loss of land and cattle that some of these Fulani then are attracted to some of these groups?
That, and also because the Fulani are very conservative Muslims as a rule. And also, if we go a little bit farther back in history, we will find out that it was the Fulani who delivered the first jihad to West Africa. It was the Fulani jihadists who, quote, purified Islam, which had existed more or less in this mostly animist West Africa since about 11th or 12th century. But about 200 years ago, this trilingual Fulani poet named Uthman Danfodjo, he launched the big Fulani jihad that actually delivered this newer, more restricted version of Islam to what today is Mali. So there, that too is part of the Fulani history. That too is something that runs in the blood.
I was also thinking a couple of years ago, an attack in Mali, efforts to control, and I think in a sense taking control of Timbuktu. These were groups, I guess, tied with Al-Qaeda and some of these other groups, including Fulani.
And they still operate in northern Mali, and there still is a very active war. And, you know, if you look at the news, there will be reports mm-hmm. of people getting killed every week. So this is something that my hosts observe. They watch these warplanes fly overhead, and they know, they hear, of course, rumors of war. They don't listen to the radio, and they obviously don't read the paper because they can't read, but they do know from other Fulani rumors of war, and they have to, because they have to know where it is safe to take their cattle. But also, this new mechanized war is flooding the region with guns.
You talk about this kind of code of stoicism, I guess, that the Fulani seem to have, sort of based on the fact that life can be hard for them.
Well, you know, I thought about it so much, and I thought, so you spend 3 weeks in this camp, and then you move on, and you spend 6 months in another camp, and then you move on. And every camp you stay in, you'll be staying next to your brother or next to your cousin or next to this relative or this very good friend, and then you have to say goodbye.
Yeah.
And then you have to say goodbye, but every time you leave, you're missing someone. But at the same time, every time you leave, you're leaving to go to the next spot where you will be arriving. So it's this almost Buddhist-like philosophy of leaving and arriving, which of course is asymptotic. It's, you know, the ideal that you can just let go and say, well, goodbye, and maybe we will meet again. That's a very idealistic thought. In fact, every time you say goodbye, your heart breaks a little bit, but then it also fills a little bit because you're going to say hello to somebody else.
That was Marty's 2015 interview with writer Anna Bodkin about her book, Walking with Abel, Journeys with the Nomads of the African Savannah. And that wraps up this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, Liz Fiedler, and John Ahrens, who edits this show. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.